Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Joe Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle. But perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Billy Joe, today on our podcast, we are so lucky to have Kelly Testy, who is currently the Law School Admissions Council President and CEO, and as of July 1, is going to take over as Executive Director and CEO of AALS.
Linda, this is going to be a really exciting podcast. Kelly Testy has done so many things in legal education. I'm excited to hear about all of those, but really about the future that she plans for AALS.
And she's such an incredibly easy person to talk to. I'm really looking forward to it. Well, good afternoon, Kelly. It's so great to have you. Law School Admissions Council President and CEO, soon to be AALS Executive Director. We can't tell you how happy we are to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. I am really excited to be here with both of you. So thanks for inviting me.
Right. We know that you even have podcasting in your background and CV with our good friend Ken. Did you like doing them? We like doing them, but we sometimes realize it's more than we thought we were taking on.
Yes, Billy, that's for sure. And I did love doing them. But you're really right. It's not as easy as just turning on the camera, right? But I do appreciate that you both do this, because I think the more we can get out the word about law and legal education and understand more about it, the better. So thanks for the effort that you're putting in.
Well, I think, you know, we've learned to make it less onerous, both on us and on our guests. And, you know, when we first started, Billy Joe and I would meet and talk with the guests first before we actually did the recording. And then we finally realized that we were killing ourselves and the guests for that matter for this little show, right? You're only going to take 2 hours of your time and talk to us. So we've moved into a new approach where we sort of wing it. So hopefully we'll get to some really good questions, but that's part of what I do is some background. So when I saw the Ken and Kelly, or Kelly and Ken, I think it was, for Barbary, as I recall, I was like, well, look at that. She has experience. One of the things in doing some research for you, I learned a little bit about your background, such as that, and it may have been a joke, but you said you wanted to be a football quarterback when you grew up. Is that true?
You know, it is true. I grew up in Indiana, and I was really quite the sports fanatic, and including wishing that I could be a quarterback of an NFL team. And I used to read biographies of quarterbacks all the time. And one day my sweet father said to me, you know, Kelly, I've got to break it to you. I think you're just a little short to see over the line. So you might want to think about a different career.
And where did you grow up in Indiana? Yeah.
I grew up in Southern Indiana, right around Bloomington, Indiana.
So I grew up in Jeffersonville.
Nice.
So, and spent many wonderful hours on the Bloomington campus. So yes. Linda, that's what we'll talk about, and then we'll get back to you.
I was going to say, yeah, because you both are Indiana grads. Kelly, you're a double Indiana grad, right? And Billy Joe, are you also double Indiana?
I have a bachelor's and a master's, and then did my law degree at NOVA. So
that's great. Okay.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. Go Hoosiers.
All right. Well, so with your interest in being a football quarterback, you transfer that to journalism, sports journalism. And I wanted to talk a little bit about how you ended up being interested in law, your communications law class that you had, and how your very kind teacher just basically said, go to the library and get this case. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, growing up, I am a first gen college grad in my family. So, you know, I didn't set out, you know, to be a law professor, dean, or you know, president of LSAC. I was really just finding my way. And as I said, I love sports. And so I played a lot of them. And that's part of what drew me to college was I was lucky to grow up in Bloomington, Indiana, you know, right where Indiana University is. And we used to always sneak into the facilities there to try and play basketball against the women's team so that we would get better. And so it was really in that process that the women on the team said, you know, you ought to try out for the team. And I kind of thought, oh, I guess I have to go to college if I'm play on the team. So anyway, one thing, you know, led to another, and I started my undergrad there, but I was working as a sports reporter at the time. And so, you know how it is when you're a freshman, you're like, what do you want to major in? Well, I had no idea. And so since I was a sports reporter, I thought, well, I'll just pick journalism. And I'm a lifelong poetry fan. But again, my father's advice was pretty sound. He said, you know, poetry seems a little academic. Maybe you could do something a little more practical. So went with journalism. And sure enough, as you ask about, Linda, one of the courses told us to go find the law library and find a case called New York Times versus Sullivan. And of course, now I know that was, you know, if we couldn't find that case, we probably had some trouble, but at the time we didn't know how big that was. But I truly will never forget the feeling of walking in that law library at Indiana University and realizing that all these cases were stories of people's lives, and just sitting on the floor and reading that case and thinking, I've found my home. Like, I love it here. And it's one of the things I think a lot about today when I hear that, you know, for instance, the ABA doesn't require books actually be in libraries anymore. You know, I love technology as much as anyone, but I still remember the feel, the smell, the being able to thumb through it, you know, all the things. And that's what got me hooked and eventually sent me to applying to law school.
You know, when you came to, so you went from law school, you clerked, actually. I think Billie Joe probably wants to ask you a question about the clerking. So I'll turn that over to her, and then I'll take back over when you go to UPS.
You clerked in the Seventh Circuit. Which judge did you clerk for?
I clerked for another Indiana University graduate. His name was Judge Jesse Eshbaugh, and he was a wonderful judge for whom I have the greatest respect and learned a lot. He was at the time had just taken senior status on the Seventh Circuit, and was also sitting by designation on the 11th. Mm. And so it was a wonderful clerkship. I got to see the Seventh Circuit in action and the 11th. And, you know, of all places, our chambers at that point were in Palm Springs, Florida. And so, you know, life could have been worse. But no, I really admired him. He was a wonderful judge, just committed to all the right values and very diligent in his work. And I really enjoyed that time.
So I just in passing, I noticed you did a visit at the University of Hawaii when you were a professor. And I'm kind of seeing a theme here in terms of staying nice and warm and beaches. But right. Let's move from there. I believe at some point you moved to the University of Puget Sound, which I called UPS. And I didn't realize, I don't know if you know this, but I was there until the spring of 92. And I believe you joined in the fall of 92. So we were like ships passing in the night.
We were.
So you went from there and you eventually became dean. And so how was that experience? What sort of stands out to you as during your time at UPS?
Yeah, I really enjoyed my time there a lot. I started teaching, as you noted, in fall of 92. I was just 1 year out of law school at the time. And in the second year I was there, that's when Seattle University announced the acquisition of the University of Puget Sound School of Law. And so that was quite a shock to us because it was a surprise transaction. It wasn't disclosed until the day it was announced. And so it brought forth a lot of change for the law school. And I think that it has been a very good thing. Seattle University has really thrived. At the time, we were all a little shocked, not only because of the sale, but because our new parent was a Jesuit Catholic institution. And so in walked a priest with a collar as our new president. And we just weren't prepared for that. But Seattle University had a very strong mission of social justice. And that really helped us grow Seattle University's law school in that mission and with those values. So I think it ended up being a very good thing, although it was surprising at the time. But it might also have been, I think, the reason why I got interested in administration, because as you can imagine, merging two law school, a law school into a new university, and all the transactional work that that requires was really very extensive. And so I got to see into the workings of a law school earlier in my career than I might have otherwise. And it also just helped me think a lot about, like, why do law schools work? What's the culture that matters? And, how do you move a school, 30 miles to the north and build a new building? And, how do you think about the kind of facilities you need and the mission and the values? So I would say that not only did I love my time teaching there and being a professor, I love my time as dean. And, still I'm in touch with a lot of my colleagues and very connected with the school. It is will always be a big part of my life and in my heart.
I always had a hard time telling people I worked for UPS though, because they'd say, "What? You work for the, no, I don't work for you that UPS." So I mean, if nothing else, the name change was an improvement. But I definitely think there's still people there that I'm very close with as well. And I've been a lot of places, but there are just some friendships you create at various schools. So it's nice for me to be a little closer to them.
Sure. Well, it's funny, our paths almost crossed there, Linda. And it's also one of the things I always remind people when they're starting out in teaching. There's such a somewhat of an intimidation about, well, I get where I need to go, and can I do this at all? And I always remind people that, I started teaching 1 year out of law school, and I started working for a school that no longer exists, and it all worked out. So,
But I think that's really important. People will say to me, I do a lot of site visits, both for ABA and AALS. And Bob Dinnerstein talked me into being on the AALS membership review committee. He said, "Oh, it's you'll love it. You love people. You'll like doing the work." No one told me how much work it was. But the terrific thing is now, 25 years later, 30 years later, I have friends everywhere. And some people will say, "Well, you just know everybody." Well, you actually do, and you can, and your lives pass differently. Some of those people you'll always be just a colleague of, and others you were their boss, and so now you're going to be the executive director of their organization. So I think that's really true about the profession, is your first job won't be your last. And all those partnerships and relationships will be meaningful.
Yes, and I think that's a great point, Billie Jo, and it's a really important point too about why that process of working on a team, a site team, where some part of the team's the ABA and some part of the team's the AALS, and you get to know what other schools look like, and you get to know the people there, and you learn a lot. And so I think it's a wonderful part of service to legal education. And particularly from the ALS standpoint, because ALS is not an accreditor. It's a member organization that exists to help the schools achieve excellence. And I find that that peer process, that process of being a colleague across institutions, is a really valuable one. And it's also a way to really enlarge your network. And as you say, then when you go to the annual meeting, there's so many people you just can't wait to see each year when you get there.
I don't think I spend much time in the meetings. I'm usually talking to all the people in the hallways, but don't tell my dean that. I don't want to skip over the University of Washington. It's gonna be like, "But wait, she was dean for us for 8 years." So, sort of moving across town, which I imagine had its own interesting aspects to it. But you were dean, honestly, for a very long time at the University of Washington. I mean, our current dean has been here about 3 years and is moving on. I think 5 years is more common, but if I read your numbers right, you were there about 8 years. So I'm kind of interested in what kept you around for so long.
Well, I also feel very blessed because I really enjoyed my time there and remain very close to colleagues there and very supportive of their new dean, Tamara Lawson, who's on LSAC's board, as it turns out. And so it was a wonderful opportunity because the schools are very different because their universities are very different. And they each have their own distinct mission and history. And so as I went to the University of Washington, it was a wonderful opportunity to really become part of an R1 big research university that had a major global footprint. And at the law school, the University of Washington had an Asian Law Center, for instance, that had been around when I joined in 2009, almost 50 years. And so we had about as many alums in China, Japan, and Korea as we did in Seattle. And so it was really interesting to see the way that a law school can in some ways, you know, teach the same things and have many similarities, but also be very different because of the differing missions of the universities and their differing goals. You know, when I joined UW in 2009, it was the time of incredible disinvestment from state institutions by the state of Washington, by many states. And it was also the start of a really difficult time in legal education as the Great Recession hit and we had contraction in enrollments. So in part, I found that those 8 years there really helped us move through some really challenging changes that needed to happen for the law school, particularly around a budget model that needed to become much more of a private model. And so when I walked in the door, we did one capital campaign. I think it was a big one then for about $85 million. And then toward the end of my tenure, we did another that was over $100 million. And so the school, as so many schools, became much more dependent upon, you know, not only tuition instead of state support, but also the generosity of wonderful donors. And I found the work at University of Washington with the alumni community there to be just so rewarding and wonderful. And I'm still very close friends with many of them because we, you know, we had to roll up our sleeves and really push forward for the school at a time that it needed the help. So enjoyed being there very much. And as you say, I was there 8 years. It goes fast. Like, you know, you can hardly believe it when you're done that it's been that long. And I was thinking about really finally taking a sabbatical at the end of that time and had let them know I was, you know, going to step down when LSAC reached out because the then current president had passed away suddenly. Mm-hmm. A wonderful leader, Dan Bernstein, who had been dean at Wisconsin and president of Portland State and just a wonderful man who I loved and enjoyed working with. But I truly had never thought about becoming the leader of LSAC. So that was something that was unexpected, but has been really interesting and just very rewarding as a challenge and opportunity.
Before we started, Kelly and I were talking about LSAC is in some ways a technology company and provider. So maybe you could expand a little bit on the surprise of that maybe, and the really great work that you are doing for law schools and admissions offices to make their jobs a little bit easier and a little more fair and equitable in the admissions piece.
Yeah, happy to do that. Yeah, I think maybe like most deans, I only knew a little bit about what LSAC did. And so as I joined and learned about the many ways that LSAC provides support for schools and for candidates, I was just amazed. But I also saw real opportunities to bring technology even more to the forefront to help make legal education more accessible and equitable and to help our schools more. So we had begun what I think of as a major digital transformation early on in my tenure and had, you know, wanted to make it easier for students to be able to take the LSAT more, you know, more times during the year and at more kinds of locations and formats. And boy, did we get some help when the COVID pandemic hit, because all of a sudden that work we'd invested in digital transformation really paid off, because we were able to make a transformation within a very short time to deliver the LSAT remotely. And we were, I think, the only testing organization that was able to make that quick pivot. And really, we were able to keep the flow of students to legal education strong during a time that had a lot of challenge. So I think that on the candidate side, what we've done is really try and just open up the doors even wider, really help the candidates see that we have our arms outstretched. We're trying to help them come into the profession, trying to make it easier, more accessible. We've done that with testing formats. We've done that with a great product called Law Hub that helps prepare them for the LSAT. We've also done that through expanding our PLUS program. That's a pipeline building program. And it's paid off. I mean, the last 3 years have been record-setting years, each of them, in the diversity of the entering law school class. And the enrollments are very strong. This year's up yet again, both in the number of people applying and the diversity of the pool. And so that's a huge accomplishment in an era when we're all seeing a lot of pushback against equity and increasing constraints on how one can work to achieve equity in admission.
Well, I know that one of the things that was important to you is really increasing the diversity of the legal profession. And I read or heard that you, one of the things that LSAC did was help cover the costs for some of the people in hotel rooms and such to be able to take exams in a quiet place or such. Did you want to expand on that a little bit?
Sure, be glad to. Yeah, I mean, we do a lot of things to help with financial need. And one of them more broadly is we have a fee waiver program that awards somewhere, you know, around $8 million or more every year in fee waivers so that people that couldn't afford to take the LSAT or apply to law school can do that without, you know, having the expense. And that program, I think, has been really important for first gen and others with financial challenge so that they know they're still able to apply to school, to law school. During the change to remote testing, we realized that, you know, technology is wonderful, but there are differences in access to technology, just as there are differences in access to every resource. And so we did two things. We made loaner computers available for free. So if somebody didn't have a laptop, we could provide them one that was ready to go. And then we also gave them vouchers to go somewhere that had a reliable internet and was quiet so that if that wasn't present at home or at a, you know, family member or a school, they would again have that. And then we also beefed up what we do for LSAT preparation. And we have a lot of free resources through Law Hub. Originally, as we were taking time to build that up, we partnered with the Khan Academy so that we could have a good partnership there. Now we have even more robust resources through Law Hub itself. But those things help. It's just really important that we always think about that access and equity as we're, you know, making any kind of change. And again, as much as technology can be a lever for equity, you have to keep your eye to make sure that there's not points where you need to make sure that you make some adjustments so that people that aren't similarly situated are put more on an even playing field.
Kelly, do you all partner with programs like the Marshall Brennan programs or pipeline programs from Access Lex, or so that I'm not sure a lot of diversity applicants or even hopefuls might even know to go to the LSAC site, or, you know, they might have an undergrad pre-law advisor, but I know some of those programs are just invaluable, but I don't know how your partnerships work.
Yeah, it's a great question, because one of the challenges for everyone that in building pipeline to law school is getting out where the potential candidates actually are and helping them see that they are wanted, their voices needed, and then helping build the pathway. And so I think the best way to think about it is LSAC is like the hub of an enormous wheel. And we partner with every one of those programs we possibly can. And Marshall Brennan's an example. There's so many great pipeline programs at many schools. A lot of those we've funded over the years to help them launch as part of the PLUS program. but then we continue to be in partnership, and our people are out there all the time speaking in those programs, providing research and data. You know, we're an enormous data and technology hub that everybody depends upon for getting all the information. And so we're really helping that big wheel, you know, turn to try and open up the pipeline into legal education. And one of the changes that we've made that I think has been really critical is the way that young people today get their information has changed. And I don't need to tell you this, you're a genius librarian, but what we've done is several years ago, LSAC sort of redoubled the work it does in outreach through social media and electronically, so that we are out there all the time where we think potential candidates will be. And, you know, so that they see the information about law school. And of course, we're also a hub for all the pre-law advisors nationally. And we support them in many, many ways. Kyle McEntee works with us now, and his work has really, you know, helped bridge the pre-law advisors' work with LSAC. So there's a lot there, but certainly we try and be everywhere we can all the time, and we're always eager for that partnership.
No, when you came to AALS, so you started on the executive committee, If Everybody Does, and that was my first year at AALS. I feel like we're either following each other, because I went to the dub right before you did. Maybe you're following me is what's going on.
That's right.
But anyway, you came in there, and one of the things I think that at the time, and I don't know where it's at today, you know, because I was, I think it was 2013, 14, around the time I was there. Definitely an increase in technology, and the uses of technology would be beneficial. And I have a feeling it would be even today. Like, I think Judy has done wonderful things with AALS, but she's had a lot to sort of bring together. And I have a feeling that your insight when you come into AALS may bring some of all these changes that you did to LSAC. But before we get there, let's go back a little bit. You did serve as president. And at the time, your theme for the ALS meeting that year was the importance of the rule of law. And it seems to me that maybe we could have done that every year since, but certainly it's a big issue right now, right? So what do you see as sort of the role of law professors in the role of law, and what can you do at AALS to sort of further this particular theme that you had so many years ago?
Yeah, that's it's one of those times when I wish I wasn't so right about that needing to be our thing, you know? But, you know, Linda, I enjoyed my time on the executive committee so much. And that was a big factor when I was contacted with the opportunity to think about this new leadership role. I just had loved that time. And then I was honored to serve as president in 2016 and enjoyed that so much. I chose that theme of, you know, why law matters, why the rule of law is so important, because it had always seemed to me that we underappreciated its role. You know, it was a little bit like the air we breathed, and until we were gasping for air, we didn't appreciate how valuable it was. And I think we've seen that play out now over and over again. And so I really thought that the Academy came together well then to really focus on how it could be even more effective in helping make more visible the critical role that law plays in equity and in democracy, and in really helping further human flourishing. That, you know, anywhere you go where the rule of law is weak, there's human suffering, there's poverty, there's violence, there's all kinds of, you know, mischief and mayhem. And when the rule of law is stronger and we're really focused on law and justice, the chances for more people to live lives that where they can flourish and be safe and well and prosper are greater. So I'm hopeful that ALS can continue to bring the law schools together, because I think the collective impact that we make in legal education is just tremendous and still not as well known as I wish it were. So I will be looking for ways to amplify that voice, to think about how technology can be a lever for us all to use to make more impact collectively in what legal education does. and ways that technology can help us be even more connected to one another across the academy. That's something that I think Judy Arena and ALS made good progress on, in helping the sections be more connected to their members. And I think we can build on that. You know, my hope is to help ALS become even more indispensable to the life of faculty and staff and administration in law school, so that everybody who's working in the law school feels ALS as a partner, and that they feel a home there, and they feel the resources and the support that they need to do their jobs better. And so I'll be looking at ways we can leverage technology to do that, ways we can leverage our tremendous volunteer network to do that, and ways we can keep helping bring a spotlight on to the incredible good work that legal education does, that I think still is more unnoticed than it could be. And so we'll be trying to help with that a little bit.
That's the great thing, because the ABA as an accrediting body really can't do those things. And so if the vacuum is not filled by a professional organization, the work can't be done in the same way.
Yes, and that's where we're just differently situated. You know, we're not a regulator. We're a cheerleader for legal education. You know, we're there to help. And so I really want to embrace that role. And also just, you know, as you think about the kinds of work that ALS does, it's a somewhat unique organization in that it's both the learned society for legal education. For each faculty member, it's their scholarly and learned society, but it is also a membership organization of all the law schools that, you know, are part of ALS. And therefore, I think when you think about those two roles, that really gives us a, you know, a nice firm place to stand to be an advocate for legal education and helping promote the schools and all that they're doing.
You know, and I was there, there's a lot going on, I guess. But I feel like we actually weren't doing the job that we should have been doing in serving our constituents in terms of that scholarship side of things. You know, for example, usually you have sort of one faculty member at every school, not necessarily, but that sort of takes on that role. Sometimes you get a title for it. I did it Mercer. Sometimes I come here and I'm just doing it, you know, because it's just what I do. But it seems to me that it would be so much easier to just have someone, for example, at AALS. It's just like, okay, I got my article done. How do I get it out there? What do I do? It's like, okay, let's talk Scholastica, or let's, you know, whatever. But it seems to me that there is, as a faculty member, had I not been involved with AALS, I think my question always would have been, what is it for me? I mean, I don't see, yes, I go to the meetings, those are fun, but that's about it, right? And so I think there's an opening to actually become something really relevant for the academy. And I don't know if you've thought about that or not. And I'm certainly not trying to put you on the spot, so you don't have to say anything. But I know that I think Judy had focused a little bit on more the membership side of things. So since she's been there and really done tremendous things there, but I'm wondering if this other piece might not be able to be something that you could focus on.
Yeah, I'm really eager to do that, because when you put it that way, you know, I want the answer to what's ALS do and why should I care? I want that to be so clear to everyone, you know, where it's like, well, of course, I can't imagine doing what I do without it. That's the goal that I'll have. And I think it starts with thinking about what are those things that we could do once that could be then leveraged so that it saves each school some money, time, effort. And it also is maybe a bigger platform so that more people can be involved in it too. You know, I'm really interested in the democratic nature of ALS too, in terms of making sure everyone feels a part of it and don't feel excluded, you know, in some way. And so I'll be definitely looking for everyone's ideas and hopes and dreams around those kinds of further improvements. And that's the fun part about leadership, is every leader does some things, and then you use that platform to build on the next stage. And I've so enjoyed working with Judy Arene, and know that she's excited about that future too, you know. And so it's going to be fun for us all to roll up our sleeves and think about how can we increasingly make our learned society what we need it to be? You know, because it's ours, it's for all of us, and our joint participation in forming it and moving it forward will be what will help it achieve what we all, you know, hope and dream of. You know, the one thing that will be interesting, and this is something that I will find a challenge and will look for ideas on, is it's small. You know, there's only about 20 employees there. You know, I contrast that with LSAC. We're big. We have almost 400. It's a very different, you know, now when you consider the volunteers for ALS, it starts to look more similar because there are about 350 people that every year give a lot of their time to the organization. There are 2,500 or so that speak every year, you know, and so that's a lot of power. And so if we can use methodologies to really help advance, you know, that work together, I think we can accomplish a lot. So that will be, you know, that's the fun of leadership, right? Is how do you take the resources you have and leverage them for everything they're worth and get more from them than you thought you could. But I know the Academy is so creative. And so I just really look forward to rolling up my sleeves and hearing ideas and working together. And I'm going to be trying to get out to all the scholarly conferences that different groups are doing, because I think there's a way if we could harness some of that and give it more platform, you know, connect some things together so they're not one and done, but they're part of a bigger network of scholarly work. That could be exciting as well.
I take the blog digest and the weekly newsletter and I send it kind of to the administration, 8 or 10 people every week. In fact, I just got them today and I'll be sending them tomorrow. But what every law school is doing is so interesting and entertaining and fascinating. The symposium lists are just amazing. Yeah. So I have an idea. I think either via Zoom or in person, it would be terrific if you could come visit each law school. So I'll invite you to Mercer. I haven't told Karen I've invited you, but I think seeing the leadership and even understanding you have 20 people versus 400, right? I just think for our young faculty, it would be so exciting for them to really know they have an organization. I mean,
yeah,
they may not even connect that conference in January as theirs. So yes, that's my idea for the podcast. So
I love it. And I am taking bookings.
Okay.
So absolutely. Because I really want to, you know, I've been to many law schools. I got out a lot as LSAC's president to schools, helping school faculties with governance and strategic planning and all manner of things, enrollments. But I absolutely agree. I want to be out among all of you and really listen, learn, and connect. And so that's a lot of what it takes. You know, there's never magic things, right? It's just, you know, you roll up the sleeves and you get out there and you start talking to people. And so that's one of the things I'm really looking forward to.
So we're getting close to...
Do we still have, so about 30 or some schools that aren't members. Is that about correct? Plus new law schools coming on every day.
Yeah.
So there'll always be new work. So
that's right. Yeah. There's still some difference between the number of ABA accredited schools and the number of ALS member schools. And I'll want to talk with them because things change. You know, sometimes when a school first starts, it may not focus on scholarship. And so that'll be something we'll take a look at as well. And I know too, that, you know, our profession right now is one that's going through huge change. You know, as an example, the ABA just proposed, should we have wholly online law schools, no residential part? You know, we may all have our own opinions about that. But we have to keep an eye on change. And, you know, I'm a big believer that, you know, my former board chair, Kevin Washburn, used to tease me and say, you know, some people fear change, but when Kelly sees it coming, she hops on a surfboard and says, let's go. And but I do believe that, you know, I like that quote that says that, you know, even if you think you don't like change, you're going to dislike obsolescence even more. And so I think we all want to know, you know, keep our eyes on the fact that the legal profession is changing. And so we need to all continue to look forward while we bring the best of what's been to help inform how we'll navigate that new future.
I think you're talking to two other surfboard riders as well. So
I know I am. I know I am.
So
I went to an AI workshop and they said it's not a train, it get on the rocket ship. So
that's a good point. So we are really getting close to time. And I have to tell you, I think this is one of the fastest I've ever realized how fast the time went in speaking with you. But Billy Jo and I were talking before we sat down with you, and she mentioned something that I thought was really poetic, not the right word, but it's all I've got at the moment. And she said, you have worked with law professors in so many different capacities. And I thought that was an interesting observation. And so my question to you is, what do you like best about working with law faculty?
For me, what I love about it is that I think law faculty are some of the smartest, best people intellectually and also in their hearts that I've ever known. You know, people really want to think creatively about law and how it, both its challenges, you know, they're honest about law's limits, but I think we all share the view that even if law is not perfect, it's still a really good pathway to a just world. And so the privilege for me as a first gen, you know, college grad who grew up in Littletown, Indiana, to get to work hand in hand with these brilliant people, I just feel like I won the lottery every day. So I love that. And I can't wait to re-engage even more fully with law faculty and staff and deans and really see what we can all accomplish together.
Well, I really can't wait to see you in that position. And, you know, if you need anything, you know where to find me, although you never know which school I'm going to be at the time. But please reach out. Be happy to work with you.
I know we'll never... You bet. We'll never be too far apart given all these overlaps we've all had. And it's really lovely.
We could end up in Bloomington someday. Who knows?
Yes. Very lovely to talk with you. Thank you for taking your time to talk to our listeners on Talking Legal Ed. Kelly, we wish you all the best. Know you're going to be super successful and can't wait to see the good things that you do when you move to AALS.
Thank you so much. I look forward to it.
Thanks so much for listening. Please come back for our next episode when we interview another nationally recognized legal expert. Talking Legal Ed is edited by Tim Spieshock. Artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. And please don't forget to leave a positive review if you like the show.